You're tuned in to the KBOO Radio Zine, and for the next half hour, we'll be dragging a local cartoonist away from her drawing board and behind the microphone. This is Words and Pictures, the show that mashes up art and literature into a colorful brew, and we're your hosts. I'm S.W. Conser.
And I'm Bill Dodge, and here in the studio, as Conch said, is Jan Elliott. Welcome, Jan.
Thanks for having me.
And Jan's the creator of Stone Soup, which is in the Oregonian. You're doing a little promotion for a new book collection of Stone Soup cartoons. And, yeah, the strip is running in almost 200 newspapers. You've got five book collections now.
I do.
Stands.
The newest book is called Not So Picture Perfect. It's an extra big collection. It's it's a little over 300 pages. We're attempting to catch up to the present a little bit more, and it's a nice book. It's got a lot of interesting stuff in it. A few extra drawings, a few photographs. It's a great collection.
Well, start by talking about the strip.
Well, Stone Soup is something that I have been working on and off since 1979, 1980. I started in Eugene with a strip called Patience and Sarah ages and ages ago in a small independent newspaper called the Willamette Valley Observer. And one of the characters from that strip, Patience, has evolved into Joan. Stone Soup stars Val and Joan, who are sisters. They're both, at the beginning of the strip, they were both single for different reasons. Val's a widow. Joan is a divorced single mom. They have three kids between them. They have their mother. They were all living in the same house at the beginning of Stone Soup. And basically, the strip is about an extended family of controlled chaos. It's just a lot going on, a lot of kids arguing, not enough money, not enough patience, not enough time. The strip has evolved, even though the characters aren't growing older. The strip has changed over time, and things have moved ahead. Joan fell in love with Wally, the nice guy across the fence, married him. I didn't want her to go too far away, so she just moved next door with him right across the fence. So they're still kind of like Everybody Loves Raymond. You know, they're still free to come and go in each other's houses, and the family still is extended and blended. But basically, it's a strip that reflects, I think, more modern family life. It's a lot about my life. I was a single mom for 10 years of two girls, just like Val. And it's just meant to be contemporary, empathetic. I want people who don't have perfect lives to feel honored by what I do and to know that they're not the only ones who had to melt ice cream because they forgot to buy milk for the kids' cereal, you know, those kinds of things.
The thing that's always kind of fun to talk about is past and present influences, artistic influences. If you'd care to tell us about who inspires you and who inspired you also when you were maybe an 8-year-old, who you were looking at in the funnies.
Yeah, well, you know, my memories of who I was looking at in the funnies is pretty much Little Abner, Dick Tracy, Peanuts, and Pogo. Those were my influences when I was a kid. Pogo when I was an older kid and could understand what the heck was going on in it.
Yeah.
And as I became a cartoonist, or at least explored the world of cartooning, one of my biggest influences was Nicole Hollander, who does the comic strip Sylvia.
Right.
And then along came Bill Watterson and made me feel so intimidated about the quality of my artwork and so inspired as to what might be possible in a comic strip, even in today's miniaturized size of comic strips.
I ran into Nicole Hollander years ago
you
in
did?
Chicago when I was living there, and I always expected to be frightened of her because she's you know, expected her to be like Sylvia.
Oh, she's great.
And in fact, she's just this really sweet, demure character.
Yeah, she is great. I got to spend a bunch of time with her at the Ohio State University does Cartoon Research Library, does a conference every 3 years. But Nicole Hollander was at this particular conference 2 years ago when I got to spend most of the time sitting with her. And, oh, what a riot she is. She is so fun.
It's too bad the Oregonian isn't still running her strip.
I know.
I had a good chuckle. They were running Zippy and Sylvia next to each other, at least in the Sunday strips. And you could tell that it was giving people at the Oregonian nightmares because they were deliberately using these really in-your-face colors.
Like
Nicole would use purple and orange right up against each other.
Just vibrating colors.
Just to kind of annoy people a little bit. And it was like anti-comics, and I was a little too much for the Oregonian.
Oh, that's great.
These really wild colors.
When you're working on Patience and Sarah, somebody offered you a contract for syndication, and what were the details?
The first line in the contract said that they would own the copyright in perpetuity, which means that Patience and Sarah would turn into... It meant that it could be... Not, it wouldn't be equal to, but it would be the equivalent of Betty Boop. It would mean that forever somebody could, besides me, could draw it. I could be fired from the strip and someone could take it over and draw it. I could lose complete control. It meant that it would go on without me, whether I wanted it to or not. And I just couldn't imagine signing a contract like that, and so I turned it down, which was very hard to do because I contacted Mort Walker. I had just met Mort Walker at a conference in New York.
The famous
Beetle Bailey creator. And he was actually very gracious and kind to me, and he said to me, if you need any assistance, feel free to call me, and here's my phone number. And it was at that conference that I met the representative from the syndicate that offered me this contract. So when this contract came in the mail, I called him to say, what should I do? And he said, the first thing he said was, well, you can hire my attorney. Well, in 1982, $200 an hour was practically, well, that was what my rent was. So, you know, I couldn't afford his attorney. But I told him about the contract, and he said, well, that's a very bad contract, and it might be the only one you ever get. And I was stunned. I thought, oh, that is a Solomon's choice if I've ever heard. You know, what on earth am I supposed to do? It might be the only contract I ever get. It might be my only shot, and it's bad. What should I do? I tried to negotiate it away. They just shut the door on me immediately. And it took, you know, another 14 years or 13 years for me to get the next contract. But I'm glad I held out in the end.
Definitely in the old days, it was not something that you owned as a creator. It was the syndicate that owned it. And that's at least some kind of an indication that things are better for artists than they used to be 50, 60 years ago. And
even 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, true.
Exactly.
Yeah, one of the things that you do nowadays is public speaking. As opposed to a lot of cartoonists who are very introverted, you're out there on the speaking tour, and one of your most popular topics is surviving criticism and rejection.
Yeah, I have referred to myself as the 16-year overnight success. It took me 16 years from the day that I thought, what a good idea to become a syndicated cartoonist, to the day that I actually started making money, real money, that I could maybe live off of or that I could see the potential of living off of as a cartoonist. I dealt with a lot of rejection. I had a lot of people tell me no. I had a lot of people tell me no politely, and I had people tell me no rudely. There were many days I wondered if I was crazy for thinking that I could compete in this world. But what it came back to was it was the only thing I had ever done that I loved so much that I lost track of time. It was something I could do for hours on end and kind of come to at 1 a.m. and realize that I was freezing. But up until that point, I hadn't realized that the temperature in my house had dropped and that I was cold. I was just so immersed in what I was doing. And I had a lot to learn in the beginning. I was completely self-taught, and it's not surprising to me that my early work was rejected because it was very clumsy. But I loved doing it, and they're just, you know, even when I did other things to make money along the way, and I had to do lots of other things to make money along the way, it was something in the background that I always just wished I could do full time. So yes, and to bring you back to the public speaking, I do a certain amount of public speaking because people enjoy hearing the story. I was also a single mom for 10 years during that struggle. I think that my story of overcoming adversity is inspiring to some, and people enjoy hearing about the comics business in general because it's something they see every day with their morning coffee and they don't know very much about. So it's a little bit of the behind the scenes. And then they like hearing that it gives them hope, I think, to know that someone can have a dream and try for it for so long and actually have it happen eventually.
Can you tell us about some of the strips that you've discovered on the web that or you wouldn't have seen otherwise?
My first day with internet access to my house was spent searching for cartoonists. Was the most wonderful thing that I could find these cartoonists all over the world that I didn't know existed. One of the first ones I found was Madam and Eve from South Africa, which I highly recommend to anyone. It's South African politics, but they know a lot about us, and we know actually more than we might think about them, so it's not like it's hard to understand. It's very funny. Michael Lunig from Melbourne, Australia, is a wonderful, wonderful cartoonist. I kind of think of him as a cross between, I don't know, Sandra Boynton, Jules Pfeiffer, and R. Crumb. I don't know where you'd put him, but he does this very cynical wonderful social comment kind of cartoon. And you can find a lot about him on the web. He has a lot of books. Mm-hmm. He has a lot of fans. There are fan sites. I really recommend people, especially people with political bent, looking him up. He's very funny.
And his sister's a cartoonist as well.
His sister Mary is a cartoonist. She has a much lighter drawing style. Her work looks very storybook-like, but her humor is very dark, not for the faint of heart. So don't be fooled by the childlike or, you know, entertaining little drawings that look like something a child could read. A child could not read her books. Claire Bredesher from France is one of my favorites. There are just amazing cartoonists from all over the world that you can find online.
Where can we see your work on the web?
You can see my work on the web at ucomics.com, the letter U, comics.com. I have a website, stonesoupcartoons.com, which offers a link to that same site. My syndicate is Universal Press, and they maintain the UComics site. And then a lot of newspapers maintain comics pages, and so you can also find it at washingtonpost.com and several other sites. Just do a Stone Soup search.
When I was living in Eugene, the predecessor to Stone Soup, Sister City, was a weekly strip in the Register Guard, and I recall the characters would take some very direct pot shots at various right-wing targets, such as the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which was sponsoring anti-gay ballot measures at the time.
Measure 9. Mm-hmm.
And you had some other pet targets that were being it could be quite political at times.
Well,
very feminist.
Yes, very feminist. I started cartooning in the late 70s, early 80s, which was very much second wave of feminism, and all my markets were local, so there was no reason for me not to do local politics. And I did it with abandoned. I had a lot of freedom in the beginning. No one was looking over my shoulder telling me what to do and what not to do. I didn't have any constraints of somebody might not get this because they don't live in Eugene. I mean, everybody who was reading it lived in Eugene. So, I just wanted to try everything at the time. And I wish, in a way, there's a part of me that would love to be a political cartoonist. Speaking of influences, if I'm going to digress here, if you haven't seen the work of Ann Telnaes, T-E-L-N-A-E-S, who is one of the most amazing political cartoonists, she won a Pulitzer as a freelance political cartoonist, which is very hard to do because you're usually sponsored by your paper. I would love if some of our local Oregon papers would carry her cartoons. She's just amazing.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO with myself, Bill Dodge, and S.W. Concer. Our guest this morning is Jan Elliott, creator of the daily comic strip Stone Soup.
You're a fan of some of the classic women artists from the early days of The New Yorker, cartoonists like Mary Petty and Helen Hawkinson.
Yeah.
Sometimes it seems like those were back in the 40s or so. Those were days when there was a lot more latitude for women to be drawing. There was some really surreal stuff. That was when Dale Messick started out with Brenda Starr.
Yeah. If you think about the history of women in the workforce in general in the United States, there were more women actresses pre-World War II. There were, if you think about the Hepburn days, Katharine Hepburn days. There were working girl strips before World War II. There were actually probably more women in cartooning before World War II and immediately after World War II than there were later in the 50s and 60s. I mean, you mentioned Brenda Starr. Dale Messick had to hide her identity as a woman in order to get syndicated. Her name is Dahlia, and she changed her name to Dale and mailed her work in so that she could get syndicated in the 50s. But prior to that, there were a lot of women in cartooning. Mary Petty was a New Yorker cartoonist in the 30s, I believe, and her work is very dark, very Munster-like, very beautifully drawn, very wickedly funny. And I found a collection of hers. Helen Hawkinson, you may not recognize the name, but if you've ever looked at any New Yorker cartoon collections, you will recognize her work. She draws the very buxom, not in a sexy way, but in an overweight way, the garden club ladies who look like on their little tiny heels they would just tip over from their large bosoms and their furs and their hats. And they're always having these funny little garden club meetings and being confused about the dues and the money. And they're very innocent, but she's kind of poking fun at the upper classes of New York at the time. And I just loved her. I loved her
subtle. The Margaret
Dumont
characters,
yes,
from the Marx Brothers movies.
Right, right.
Yes.
The foils, yes.
Exactly. And her creation story is interesting. How she worked with a man who was in the theater. And they walked around the city, New York, in Manhattan, basically, every Friday afternoon. And they just he listened and she drew people on the steps of the Metropolitan Opera, people on the steps of the museums. They just listened to people talking. She made little sketches, and then they would go to dinner together and discuss what they'd seen, and she would draw things up, and that's what she submitted to the New Yorker the next week. And they worked together like that for 17 years. So I, growing up more on magazine cartoons than on comic strips, and when you asked me about my influences earlier, I forgot actually to frame that, because my first and strongest influences were from magazine cartoons like what was in the Saturday Evening Post and New Yorker Magazine and Life Magazine. I loved magazine cartoons, and I still... Eldon Zadini just died. Did you know that? An absolutely consummate Playboy, Esquire, New Yorker cartoonist.
Great with a brush.
Wonderful. Oh, wonderful cartoonist. I got to the pleasure, had the pleasure of getting to know him through Charles Schulz. Those cartoonists were, I just love the humor and the drawings and the old magazine cartoons.
Now, this reminds me that one of the responses you would get whenever a comic syndicate would reject you was, we already have a woman cartoonist. We have Nicole Hollander or Lynn Johnston or Kathy Geiswhite.
Yeah.
And that's something also women columnists in the newspaper will hear all the time. We have an Ellen Goodman or Molly Ivins.
And what does gender have to do with what Molly Ivins writes about or what Ellen Goodman writes about? I mean, other than that, as a woman, you're going to bring a certain perspective, but those women do not write Hints from Heloise. You know, they write politically astute columns. It's very interesting to me that it was ever put to me, we have Lynn, we have Kathy, why do we need you? I mean, is there a quota? Why would there be a quota? I mean, why do we need another animal strip? Why do we need another strip about a little boy? I mean, what we need are strips that are funny. What we need are people who are intelligent.
That really illustrates really strange attitudes that still prevail in the United States about gender and class and race. We tend to think that we're really far advanced in the early 21st century, but getting those kind of responses, that's just so archaic, you know. It's bizarre that you had to go through that.
Well, and it's not over, I don't think.
No, that's what I meant.
I'm sure that there are black cartoonists who were expected to only write about black issues. You know, that's what you bring to the funny pages. That's what you should write about. I'm sure there are all kinds of people who were expected to perform based on race or gender or age or whatever. And maybe it's back to our desire to niche market or something.
Right. Everything has to have a convenient category.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's as if the features section of the paper now is being completely run by some guy from the marketing department.
Yeah. I think that newspapers have lost track of what the comics pages are about and how to fill them with material that's going to be interesting to people. I mean, bottom line, what people want is something that's funny. And looking for something that is a niche over something that's funny is just never going to work. It's just absolutely not going to work. And unfortunately, they're not looking for things that are interesting to look at anymore either, because funnies have gotten so small that it's harder and harder to convince people that the artwork matters. And I think that's kind of discouraging, because I think one of the things that was great about the funnies, always has been great about the funnies, is that you could get lost in this little miniature world, and that's getting harder and harder to do.
One of the ironies that I notice about, you hear men in the comics industry complaining because they say women's material isn't edgy enough. But when you do write something controversial, the boot comes down. One of our earlier guests, Jack Oman, bemoaned how the newspaper comics page has gotten terribly old-fashioned, stuck in some fabled past. Lynn Johnston, a few years ago, ran a very innocent, gay-themed storyline in her strip For Better or For Worse, and it brought down the wrath of readers. There were cancellations in letters and editorials, and she said she'd never do it again.
I didn't hear her say that she'd never do it again, but I can imagine that, and she's kind of tough. She's pretty tough, and for her to feel that way, she did really feel the wrath from across the country. Of course, she had lots of supporters, and interestingly, she felt the wrath at the beginning of the series. If people had held their comment, their thought, their perspective until they'd read the entire series, I think that she would have experienced much less angry mail. I also heard that the largest amount of mail from any one area that she got was from Grants Pass, Oregon. And I was embarrassed to be an Oregonian when I heard that. Because if you watched the Lawrence series and read it all the way through, you couldn't be anything but sympathetic. And a lot of people came around and said, yes, of course, we understand what this is about. This is about family. This is about difficulty in a family. But people just react. I don't know why that is such a hot button issue, but people react so strongly to that.
Well, do you feel at all limited in how much of your own social and political views you can work into the strip? Do you have to be a little stealthy to keep from making the syndicate nervous?
The syndicate is willing to let me do whatever I'm willing to take grief for. The syndicate is, my syndicate in particular, Universal Press, is quick to say, we'll stand behind whatever you want to do. However, you need to know that. You may have people, you know, burning crosses on your lawn or, you know, sending you hate mail or, you know, you never know what the reaction is going to be if you tackle certain topics. I have to admit that there are things I probably haven't tackled because I didn't want to get the grief. And people, especially with email, are so quick to send you angry letters. It's really distressing. And this is going to sound a little bit chicken, but the one consideration here is that Lynn Johnston is in 2,400 papers. And so if she gets even 10% cancellations, she's still doing just fine. You know, yeah. I'm in 150 to 200 papers. I have to say that there's a certain part of me that doesn't want to risk too much cancellation. On the other hand, I'm in 9 countries. And a lot of the countries that where Stone Soup runs are much more liberal than the United States. Norway, Sweden, Finland. You know, there are places where I could say things in my strip, Portugal, that I can't say here or that I'm reluctant to say here because we're so much more conservative. So, ironically.
Well, I remember in your weekly strip, your predecessor, Sister City, the main characters were single. It was pretty much a women's cast, and they're busy with their kids. But Stone Soup, the daily strip, introduced a couple of love interests. And I was wondering, did you sense any pressure to add male characters to the strip?
One of the reasons I went with Universal Press is that they were the only syndicate that didn't say to me, don't you think she needs a boyfriend? King Features, that was one of the first things they said to me. This is a long time ago. Don't you think she needs a boyfriend? Isn't divorce kind of depressing?
And God forbid she should be a lesbian.
Oh, yeah.
Or anybody imagine.
And initially when the strip came out, there were readers who wrote in and said, what are you doing putting this lesbian strip out there? Because there are two women living in a house together. My editor had to keep, my first response is, so what if they are? The second response is, if you read the strip, you'll see that they're sisters. And we don't mean sister in some, you know, political fashion. We mean they're really sisters. But that gets people's ire up is so amazing to me. I had not introduced men initially because I didn't want to do the cliche of the negative, stupid, bullheaded buffoon. I didn't want to have a male character at all if I couldn't have a male character that was the kind of male I might want in my life. And it was just too classic at the time to create a character that was someone you just was a target, you know, that was the feminist foil, the misogynist, whatever. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to create Wally. And until I really had it in my head who Wally would be and that he would be a decent, sweet man, I have a real fondness for androgyny, and, you know, Wally likes to cook and Joan can't, and, you know, kind of bringing everybody to the middle is sort of where I see humanity going.
Wally also likes power tools.
He likes his power tools, that's right. Maybe he does consider the iron a power tool, however. He also is the ironer in the house.
Maybe we should take a moment and have you read.
Yeah, one of my favorite storylines in Stone Soup is pretty much political one in the best sense. That's the one where the public school kids from the underfunded classroom take over the locker room at the university sports complex, which is definitely Autzen Stadium at the University of Oregon. Having lived in Eugene, I can see it's this palatial sports complex.
Well, when I read that the university football locker room had been remodeled to the cost of $27,000 a locker. I live in a town where, you know, classrooms are overcrowded, schools are crumbling. My daughters went to a high school that was crumbling. I knew that this was not money from the same pot exactly. Because, okay, you can say it's donor money, you can say whatever you want to say. And what is called the athletics arms race, which is why the athletic department at the University of Oregon would consider remodeling their locker rooms in this fashion, is so they can recruit against other schools that have similar locker rooms. I knew that I could write about this, and it would appeal not just in Eugene, but across the country, because our university is not the only university doing this. But it's a choice as a society that we're making, that this is where we're funneling our money instead of into third grade reading classes and teachers' aides and resource libraries for elementary schools. But anyway, I could not resist. I have a character named Ms. Winget, and she is one of Holly's middle school teachers, and I couldn't resist doing something. I mean, the pictures, they did a whole article in the Register Guard about this locker room, and it was the opulence, you know, the Xbox, the 64-inch plasma screen TVs, the stuff that I just thought, this is outrageous. They're just feeding me lines. So this is a initial strip where Val comes to visit Ms. Winget's classroom, and she's looking around the classroom, and she said, "Ms. Winget, I thought there were 35 students in this class." Ms. Winget says, "There are." Val says, "But there are only 33 desks." "Mm-hmm. How do you manage that?" And Ms. Winget hollers to the back of the room, "Tim, Danny, try to sit still on those mop buckets. The clanging is distracting." So these are two kids who don't even have their own desks. After Val sees the classroom falling apart, pieces of the ceiling are falling down, she says to Ms. Winget, "I have an idea of how we can get you into a better classroom. We just need a little help accessing it." Ms. Winget says, "What kind of help?" And Val looks out in the classroom, and she says, "Who knows anything about hacking?" And all the kids are raising their hands. Now, the reason this is a joke is because in order to get into the football locker room at Autzen Stadium, they have a thumbprint recognition pad. This is how you get in. So Val takes the kids down, and of course, you know, little Jeremy can disable the thumbprint recognition scanner, and they're in no time. And it goes on where she decides that this locker room is a much better facility than her classroom, and she's going to start holding her classes in this classroom. And they're eventually discovered by the athletic director, and the football players eventually want to sit down and join the class because they'd like to learn something about math and the Constitution. And, you know, it was a little hard on football players, but I think I made my point.
Any projects you've got coming up in the future that are new and exciting?
One of the things that's that I'm kind of proud of at the moment, I did a series maybe a year or 2 years ago now, where Holly and Alex went to visit their great aunt Marge in California, and they think they're going for a surf vacation. They're going to be hanging out on the beach with surfer dudes in bikinis, and it turns out when they get there, they've actually been invited down to participate in a house built, basically a Habitat for Humanity house that's being built. And I wrote the series as a way to give Holly a chance to become a little bit enlightened. She's a little bit self-interested, kind of typical middle schooler. But, of course, middle schoolers are not always just self-interested. They do have moments where they are very interested in what's going on in the world around them. And I wanted Holly to have this realization that the world was bigger than her, and that's why I did the series. Habitat for Humanity was very enamored with the series and invited me to help them promote a couple of their programs. So Holly, Alex, Val, and Joan are being used to promote Women Build and Girls Build, two programs of Habitat for Humanity International. I'm very proud of that. I think it'll be a great fun for me, and I hope it'll be bring some awareness to those two programs for Habitat for Humanity as well. The tagline, which is the very last line of my series, "Who knew blisters could feel so good," is going to go along with the Val and Joan Women Build images. So I've just started working with them in the last year. I got to go to a Women Build on Long Island last fall. It was really exciting and wonderful. So that's kind of a cool thing. I'll be doing that over the next 3 years.
Well, Well, we would love to go on for longer than we have, but we're running out of time. And you've been listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO with Bill Dodge and SW Concer. Our guest this morning has been Jan Elliott, creator of the daily comic strip Stone Soup. Jan, before you go, tell us where to find your new book.
You can find my new book at any bookstore in Portland. If you don't see it on the shelves, just ask for it to be ordered, and you can find it online or at my website, stonesoupcartoons.com.
Stay tuned for more of the Radio Zine on your community radio station, KBOO.
And thank you, Jan.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM at 11 on Democracy Now!, a conversation with Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things, and other books. She'll discuss India, Iraq, U.S. Empire, and dissent. Stay tuned at 10:30 for Stage and Studio. Hear about the female odd couple from Integrity Productions. And for Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, the story of frontier woman Lalu Nathoy, otherwise known as Polly Bemis in Idaho. And now, Per Fogering speaks with Stephen Zarlenga of the American Monetary Institute about monetary reform.